When StoryCorps was in Kansas City over the summer, pairs of locals entered an Airstream trailer outside the Nelson and swapped stories. One day, two women came by and talked about the neighborhood they grew up in, a neighborhood that's pretty much gone now. Leeds was over by the stadiums on the banks of the Blue River.
It was rural. We had woods. We used to go crawdad hunting. And we used crawdads in the backyard. We played baseball. We played football. I had a really, really almost magical childhood.
That's Cheryl Looney talking to her sister, Earlene Bentley. They remembered what Leeds was like when new people arrived.
Leeds was a place where people from the deep south come up to live with their relatives that lived in Leeds to start a new life. I was a kid and they were so country, and that dialogue, they had the thick accent, and sometimes they'd be saying things to me, and I said, my mother said, don't you hear him talking to you? I don't know what they were saying. Because I couldn't understand that dialogue. They would come to Leeds and everybody would stand around and look at them really funny. Who are those people? Ooh, ain't they country? Ooh, they can't talk.
The team here at Central Standard found this whole conversation both charming and intriguing. So we invited Cheryl and Earlene to come talk with us specifically about Leeds. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with Earlene Bentley. Hi, Earlene.
Good morning.
And Cheryl Looney. Good morning to you, Cheryl.
Good morning to you as well.
If you out there have a story about Leeds, if you remember Leeds, call 816-235-2888 to join the conversation. A historian will be joining us shortly. But Cheryl, Earlene, tell me what you remember about day-to-day life in Leeds. What are some things that really stand out in your memory?
One of the things that stand out in my memory as a child, we used to go to an area called Big Dusty. And it was a summer program. And one of the people that ran the program, Miss Mason, she lived in Leeds. And her name was Miss Willoughby. Every summer, she would come out. We would go to Big Dusty. Big Dusty would be right across the street from Dunbar Elementary School. We get there at 8 in the morning. We didn't leave until 4 or 5 in the evening or afternoon. We had games to play. We had arts and crafts. We had our own baseball team. We would go to different parks and play against different teams. And I had the best childhood in Leeds because I felt safe.
You felt safe there?
I felt very, very safe, secure, because I knew if anything happened, somebody was going to come to my rescue.
It was a tight-knit community, it sounds
very like. Very tight-knit. Now, we did have our own problems among ourselves, but we all stuck together. Everybody looked out for everybody's kids. And it was just a very safe and secure environment. And I didn't know we were poor until we moved out of Leeds.
Who lived in Leeds?
My family, then we had the Randolphs, we had the Masons, we had the Malones, we had the Whitmills, and like I said, and we were all, the kids, we were all around the same age. So we never lacked having anybody to play with. And I was born at home because when my mother went into labor, she thought she was having gas pains.
Oh, my gosh.
This one doctor, Dr. Moore, up until Dr. Moore passed away, whenever I went to his office, he would always come out and tell the story. And he never called me Cheryl. He always called me gas pain.
So that's the kind of level of familiarity that existed in Leeds.
And see, and he was
that you were known by the story of your mom's labor.
And during that period of time, it was rare that if you were black, you could go to a white doctor's office and actually sit in the waiting room. It didn't matter to Dr. Moore. He didn't care what color you were. He treated everyone, at least from my perspective.
And he was a doctor in Leeds?
Yes.
Well, so, Earlene, we're going to get back to these questions about race, but I am curious from your perspective, what really just jumps out at you when you remember Leeds?
What jumps out at me is the unity among the residents of Leeds. If you were doing something you weren't supposed to do, your parents, they got the news because everybody knew everybody else. And everybody pretty much knew everybody's business. So you really couldn't get away with anything because it was a tight-knit community.
What were the boundaries of Leeds? Do you remember?
I don't.
Do you, Cheryl?
I think it was from 31st, and it's now called Stadium Drive. At the time, it was Raytown Road, all the way up to the Chevrolet plant, and I'll say from the VA hospital over to Raytown Road.
Well, we're going to get more of your memories, but I want to bring a historian in. Gary Kramer is with us from the State Historical Society of Missouri. He's the executive director and senior fellow at the Center for Missouri Studies. Hi, Gary.
Good morning.
So is that your sense of where the boundaries are as well?
Ultimately, but initially, there were kind of two communities. You may remember there was Couch's first edition, which was the first, began in about 1915, and that's...
When you say the first what?
The first edition. I'm sorry. It was called Couch's First Edition.
Okay.
And
that's a neighborhood?
That was a neighborhood that was a little more west of the Blue River. And then about a decade later, as the community filled up, as the space filled up, it expanded all the way to the Blue River, to Allen Street. And then that became the Allen's division, subdivision. And then by that time, those two subdivisions together began to be called Leeds.
So what is the story of Leeds? Who lived there? What brought people there?
It is a perfect illustration of what historians call a great migration community. As African Americans began in the early 20th century, but especially in the era of World War I, to leave the South for the North and the Midwest, and also to leave rural Missouri for urban Missouri. I think over about a 30-year period, the black population of Kansas City almost triples. And by 1920, the figure is something over 30,000 African-Americans. The first movement was into the inner city, the 18th and Vine corridor. But there were many African-Americans from the rural South who didn't want to live in the city. They wanted to be able to replicate their Southern lifestyle, have their butchering hogs, their milk cows, their big gardens, to hunt and to fish. And it's those folks who move out to Leeds and begin to buy land, which is affordable. Leeds was part of Kansas City. It was just barely in the city limits, but it did not have city services. So the streets weren't paved. There was no running water. There was no indoor plumbing. But again, for people coming up out of the South, this is exactly what they wanted. It was close enough to the 31st streetcar stop that they could catch the streetcar and go into town and work in a variety of jobs as domestics or as janitors or that sort of thing.
So remind me of the time period we're talking about here.
We're talking about primarily, Leeds really starts in 1915. Mm-hmm. I would say if you had to find a golden period, it's probably 1920 to about 1940.
So this is post-slavery, pre-integration.
Yeah, Missouri is a very Jim Crow state at this time period. The schools are segregated. There is an understanding, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, but there's kind of an understanding that African Americans will live primarily east of Troost and north of 28th Street. So there's what is distinctive about Leeds is that virtually everybody from all socioeconomic classes live there. The black doctors, the lawyers, the preachers, the teachers are right next door to the working class. And that's really, I would argue, one of the great strengths of the community.
So is that, I want to just jump back and ask Cheryl and Arlene, is that the story of what brought your parents and your family to Leeds? Does that sound familiar, or do you have a different story in your family?
I really don't know. I remember my mother as a child, she said she lived on the North End, and they heard about these houses being built in Leeds, and so her family moved to Leeds. My father, at that time, his father lived over on 23rd Street, which I thought was unusual, and he moved to Leeds. And all the houses, I don't care how many children you had, you only had, I think, two bedrooms. And they were on, I think they were, we had a slang for them, called them shotgun houses, because you could go in the front door and see everything. Everything was just straight, you know.
And this memory that the historian is sharing with us about no paved streets, no running water.
That's right. And no indoor toilets. So I can remember the outhouse. Then I can also remember, I don't remember the year, but I can remember when we got our bathroom. We were so excited to have an indoor bathroom. Now, you didn't have to, you know, when it was cold and raining, you didn't have to bundle up to go to the bathroom.
What year was that? Do you remember when you got a bathroom?
Late 40s or early 50s, yeah. I believe, because I was born in 1940.
Okay.
What are the stories that you all have heard about what defined Leeds or what brought people to this community? Is that something that you talked about?
As a child, like I said, we moved out of Leeds when I was in like the fourth grade. And as a child during that time, when adults were together and having conversation, as a child, you didn't stay there. You went outside and played.
That's right.
This was not
children
your business.
Children were not allowed to sit around with adults. Children were not allowed to interrupt adults. Children were allowed to be children.
So you went outside and played.
Yeah, you went outside and played. And it was, you know, it was like unspoken. When my parents, if we were all in the living room looking at TV and some people came to see my mother or my father, it was an unwritten rule. You turn the TV off, you get up, and you go outside and you play.
So you did not hear what people
no.
were saying, but not, you didn't no. know what the grown-ups were saying.
Mm-mm.
May I interrupt? Yeah. Something Arlene said made me think of something, and that was there was a lot of extended family living. Even though these were small houses, the land was owned by whites, mm-hmm. and the houses were built by whites who were clearly speculators. You know, they were in this to make money. But they sold the houses on credit, very easy, relatively easy payments. I recall interviewing people. In fact, I interviewed Earlene and Cheryl's mother and their brother in 2001. But I remember them talking about, you know, physically going to, on a Sunday, going to the owner's house with a payment mm-hmm. Of money. And the houses were very small. They all had front porches. And so in the summer, the front porch was kind of an extended bedroom. But, for example, when Cheryl and Arlene's parents were married, they initially lived with their mother's parents.
Right.
So it was a large family of people living, sharing in this mm-hmm. very small space. Mm-hmm. But it was part of the way of survival and the way of making do, of combining resources, that it really was kind of a village raising a child
yeah,
in that
it was.
Regard.
Mm-hmm.
Did you experience it that way, a village raising you as children?
Right. Because sometimes you got in trouble, which is rare, you know, the preacher would scold you about it, the neighbors, And then you would think, you know, how did they find out? But, you know, that was the way it was. And that's one of the things that I remember, and I also remember groups of women gathered at the bus stop in the morning. They would go, as we called it, downtown to do housework. They did housework, and they would all be gathered at the bus stop. Be maybe 10 or 12 ladies. It was domestic work, and they called it day work, because you'd go to one house today and clean, then maybe somebody else's house tomorrow and clean. And then you can remember those same women about 4:30 or 5 o'clock getting off the bus, going to their own homes. Mm-hmm. And that went on for years.
Another thing I remember that ran through the stories of the people I interviewed, picking up on what you're just saying, mm-hmm. is that in a sense, the children were almost raised communally. So if a mother worked, there was just an understanding that there was some other mother across the street or mm-hmm. next door who would care for those children. You know, it wasn't a daycare. It wasn't even formal babysitting. It was mm-hmm. just a shared communal responsibility for the raising of the children.
Because I remember when I finally did go to college. I went to college late. And we were talking, and this one professor, he was talking about the, quote, black experience. And I must have had this strange look on my face. And he asked me, he said, well, Miss Looney, do you not agree with me? I said, no, I don't agree with you. I said, number one, we never lived in the projects. We never lived in an apartment. We were never on welfare. We were never on food stamps. I said, and in the morning, those that did have a car, it would be like a caravan. Every morning, three lights were on in the morning, the bathroom, the bedroom, and the kitchen light. By 6:30, you see cars backing out of the driveway going to work. So I told him, I said, so what you're talking about, I've never experienced. So, and then he made the statement, you're the exception. I said, no, I was the rule. Because that's what I grew up with. We grew up with, you work hard, you do your best, you succeed. If you fail, you can't blame anyone but yourself. Stand on your own two feet and do what you have to do. Because I remember one time I was talking to my grandfather, my dad's father, and I was saying, well, I don't want to go to college. And he said, well, the only way out of your situation is to go to college. Well, at that early age, I was the first thing that came to my mind is, well, what situation?
Because the situation felt not fine to you. Yeah,
like, what situation are you talking about? And then it dawned on him. I had no idea what he was talking about.
I just want to jump in and let our listeners know that we're talking about a neighborhood called Leeds, an African-American community that had something of a golden age, it sounds like, between 1915 and 1940. And it's over by the stadiums near the Blue River.
Mm-hmm.
And
it was self-contained.
Can you tell me what it was that prompted your family to leave? We're talking with Cheryl Looney and Earlene Earlene Bentley about their childhood there.
My mom wanted a bigger house. And with both of them working, they've always had pretty good jobs. She wanted better. And that's when we moved out of Leeds.
What? I'm here with also historian Gary Kramer. And Gary, tell me more about some of the sort of milestones in Leeds, how that community changed.
I refer to the golden age as the 20s and the 30s, but actually I would extend it really through World War II, because World War II brought a lot of jobs to Leeds. There was the Chevrolet plant across the river. There was the Thai plant. So it brought a relative degree of prosperity. But what happens in the mid-50s, and that's about the time your family left, I remember interviewing a man, and I think this was an exaggeration, but he said the best house in Leeds wasn't as nice as the worst house in the white community. I think that's extreme, but I think what you're talking about is exactly what happened when open housing occurred. When segregated housing became illegal, many people in Leeds, particularly the middle and upper middle class, the the preachers, the teachers, the doctors, and so forth, found that because of the prosperity of World War II, they could afford other places outside of Leeds and the white communities, and they started moving. And I think this is something that happened all over the United States. Mm-hmm. Leeds has its counterpart in St. Louis in a community called Kinloch, and it has almost the identical story. Mm. And it begins to decline. And I want to emphasize what Cheryl in particular is saying. Leeds defied every stereotype of a ghetto. There was, by my research, there was no teenage pregnancy. There was no drug use. There was no abandonment by men of their families.
These are strong agreement from Cheryl and Erlene. Mm-hmm.
There, I think I looked. I can't remember. I remember looking at census figures, and you know, something like property ownership was in the mid 90%, and two parent households were in the mid to upper 90%. I mean, these were stable communities with strong churches. The school was in many ways the center of the community. I remember interviewing a man who said, one of the characteristics of these teachers is, quote, they would not let you fail.
No,
these were teachers who knew the students, who knew the parents, who knew the community, and were part of the community.
Mm-hmm. And that's the truth. Like I said, Leeds was self-contained. And I think I had the same kindergarten teacher that Erlene and Ronald and Anita had.
Right.
I had the same first grade teacher. And they would not allow us to feel sorry for ourselves.
What does that mean? Can you tell me more about how you felt that?
Well, with me, I was a slow learner, especially with reading. But I had this one teacher, whenever I wanted to give up, Miss Harris would come, she would grab me, would take me out in the hall, would tell me, and put her finger in my face, little girl, I know you can read because everybody else in your family can read. You're going to learn how to read. Then I had another principal who wanted to put me in a special ed class, but this one teacher stuck right by me. I said, she's lazy. She's gotten away with not doing different things. But as time grew on and the trust built up, then something clicked. You can't do this. But Miss Harris or Miss Love, she would never, she would let any of us give up.
You know, I'm struck by your experience in college when you had a professor telling you what the Black experience was, mm-hmm. and your experience had not been anything like what he was describing. And it, with Leeds being a neighborhood that, of course, you remember it, you lived there, but the larger community, it seems, has largely forgotten Leeds, that it's not a place that you hear about in the broader discourse about history in Kansas City. And I wonder if when we leave out the stories that defy stereotypes, what that leaves us with.
It leaves us with a sense of history that African Americans were people to whom things happened, not people who took their own lives into their hands and created their own destinies. That's what's distinct about Leeds. These were people who created lives for themselves, good lives,
mm-hmm.
Lives that obviously people such as Cheryl and Erlene remember very favorably. So it's less about what happened to people than it is what people made happen for themselves.
Are there people who you remember from Leeds whose stories you would like to share with us? People, characters who you think should be remembered?
Well, there were characters out at Leeds. They, as the old people used to call it, they liked the devil's juice. And they were, those guys could be really comical.
And comical, so
we had a Dalmatian, we named him Spot. And the guys weren't supposed to be drinking under the river. Well, when the police came by, our dog Spot was a Dalmatian, but he was also deaf. He would stand by the riverbank and wag his tail. That let the police know that the boys were down there drinking. And so they would all go and arrest him. And so one of the guys told my mother, Y'all need to get rid of that dog. That dog's a snitch.
And I remembered my aunt's mother-in-law. Her name was Grancy. Every morning when Grancy got up, she put her hat on.
That's right.
She wore that hat all day long. That's the first thing she put on her head when she got up in the morning was her hat.
And came on the front porch and
right,
sat.
Right away.
And you couldn't go in her refrigerator.
No. We found out years later, because she was a staunch Christian, we found out years later that she and Gramps kept beer in the refrigerator.
That's why you couldn't go in the refrigerator?
You could go to her house and she would say, don't you go in that refrigerator. And, you know, we little kids, we had to obey. So anyway, Leeds has produced some really funny characters, as it's produced some good people.
Yeah.
Like Al Brooks come from Leeds. Senator Yvonne Wilson come from Leeds.
And the actor Donald Cheadle. He's from
Leeds. Yeah, his people are from Leeds. So there were good people in Leeds. And our kindergarten teacher, she was from Leeds.
She was from there and teaching there.
Yeah, and she was the first kindergarten teacher. She went to Lincoln University, where some of the people from Leeds went. And she was the first kindergarten teacher.
If people are going to remember one thing about Leeds, that just leaving them with one thought as we go today, what do you want it to be?
It was a self-contained, positive environment for children.
Oh. It was an active community. And I felt protected and cared about.
Cheryl Looney, Earlene Bentley, thank you so much for sharing your memories.
Thank you.
And Gary Kramer with the State Historical Society of Missouri, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Gina Kaufman. Up next, my fellow Kansans digs into an issue that Kansas politicians have to take a stand on if they're going to win elections. The story of how abortion became central to Kansas politics in just a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now, as part of our coverage of the governor's race in Kansas, we're teaming up with our friends at the Kansas News Service to bring you weekly episodes of their new podcast, My Fellow Kansans. They're getting stories behind some of the puzzling aspects of Kansas politics that longtime residents might take for granted on this week's episode, how it came to be that a stand on abortion can make or break a Kansas politician. My Fellow Kansans with Jim McLean.
If there's been one constant in Kansas politics for the last 30 years, it's that Republicans seeking statewide office must be unequivocally against abortion and for overturning Roe v. Wade. Any wavering, any change of heart is a vulnerability for opponents to exploit.
But Kris Kobach, when he ran for the Kansas Senate, he said he was pro-choice. And that was when he was a constitutional lawyer for years who knew that right to abortion was not in the U.S. Constitution.
Knowing how potent the issue is in GOP politics, Governor Jeff Collier chose a key moment in one of the final debates of the primary campaign this summer to question Secretary of State Kris Kobach's anti-abortion credentials.
Secretary Kobach.
So first of all, let's be clear. Kansans for Life gave an endorsement to me, and I will be honest, gave two endorsements. I also endorsed Governor Collier.
It wasn't the first time that Kobach had been forced to own up to his pro-choice past, and affirm that he's since seen the light.
After I graduated from law school, single man, I read all the cases, Planned Parenthood versus Casey. They had all these exceptions, and I thought, oh yeah, I guess these exceptions are okay. Then I got married. Then I saw our first baby, Lily, in my wife Heather's womb. And I saw her little feet cycling, like she was riding a bicycle. And I said, wow, I've never seen this before. No one in Yale Law School is showing ultrasounds to the law students. And my views changed, because then if you realize that it is a human baby in the womb, then you can't make exceptions. None of the exceptions make sense anymore.
I'm Jim McLean, and this is My Fellow Kansans, a podcast from the Kansas News Service. On this week's episode, we'll talk about the people and events that pushed Kansas politics to the right. In particular, the event that virtually everyone agrees triggered the shift. Summer of Mercy abortion protests that gripped the city of Wichita in 1991.
A priest was arrested, as were praying women.
touching pictures of dead fetuses.
We're just trying to save babies.
We'll talk to people who were there and recount how the protests energized conservatives, fueled their takeover of the Kansas Republican Party and eventually the State House, culminating in Sam Brownback's election as governor in 2010.
So with faith in God and the good people of Kansas, Jeff Collier and I accept your election to be lieutenant governor and governor of this great state of Kansas.
Brownback, of course, is now gone, but the conservative coalition that propelled him to the governor's mansion remains a force, a big one, in Kansas politics. And the anti-abortion faction is squarely behind Republican Kris Kobach in this year's race for governor. Let's take a step back just for a minute. The Summer of Mercy in 1991 wasn't the first time abortion was a flashpoint in Kansas. In 1974, a Democratic congressman, a Topeka obstetrician, campaigned against the sitting Republican Senator Bob Dole with a fiscally conservative message.
Bill Roy believes the rest of the nation can take a lesson from Kansas.
You can have progressive government and government that meets the needs of people without increasing income taxes or sales taxes or other taxes every year. We haven't done that here. And I think we've had good government.
Dr. Bill Roy, a respected voice for Kansas.
Roy had performed a handful of abortions as an Air Force doctor, but nobody predicted that would weigh heavily in the Senate race. At the time, Kansas's abortion laws were some of the most liberal in the nation, and the polls had the congressman well ahead of Dole in the final week of the campaign. But the Roe v. Wade decision 2 years earlier was starting to make abortion a more visible and contentious issue, and the Dole campaign went after it.
The Dole campaign is smearing Bill Roy.
Leaflets called Roy an abortioner and identified Dole as pro-life.
He slanders Roy's good record in the Air Force. Hate materials against Bill Roy appear in the newspaper and on the streets.
Roy called it dirty politics, but in a 2007 oral history, he remembered the last-minute flurry of accusations as what turned the tide in the election.
Because on the Sunday before, the conservative churches and the Catholic churches had been leafleted on Bill Roy's abortions. And in other words, there's no question in my mind I would have beaten him by 50,000 votes without that.
Still, it wasn't until a couple of decades later that the power of the abortion issue really became apparent, even to Roy.
I won't tell you abortion is not a legitimate political issue. I don't think I knew it in the early months before election as much as I know it now. But as I said, abortion equals the Christian right, equals the Republican Party.
We follow Jesus.
Protesters with the Pro-Life Action Network started the day at another clinic for women across town, carrying tombstone-shaped placards under the watchful eye of police. Their goal, to stop Dr. George Tiller from performing abortions.
The 1991 Summer of Mercy abortion protests, staged by Randall Terry, the flamboyant leader of Operation Rescue, tied the city of Wichita in knots for weeks.
Our next move is to continue to do all that we can to save the children in this town that are scheduled to die and to encourage people to settle in for the long haul.
Terry picked Wichita because of George Tiller, a former Navy flight surgeon who was one of a relative few doctors across the country who did late-term abortions.
This is the capital of the late-term abortion with Dr. George Tiller, affectionately known as Tiller the Killer around the country among pro-lifers.
Night after night, there was footage on the network news of protesters locking themselves to clinic gates and lying on the hot pavement to block traffic.
Well, Mark, the group known as Operation Rescue has pledged to block the gates of this clinic around the clock for the rest of the week.
You're ready for war! You're ready for the enemy! You're ready for...
We had a gentleman, an anti-choice protester, who U-locked himself by the neck to our front doors. I kept thinking, oh my goodness, if his feet were to come out from underneath him, he would strangle himself.
And it was so hot, the pavement, if you can imagine when it's over 100 degrees, what that was like. But these people had come prepared and they had ice water in jugs, and they were dumping the water onto the street so they wouldn't burn themselves. Yeah.
Operation Rescue has targeted Wichita with virtually all of its resources, hoping to establish an anti-abortion beachhead in the heartland.
It was a spectacle that captured the nation's attention and that of talk show host Phil Donahue.
This is the city that has found itself on the front page of every newspaper in the world in recent weeks. This is also a city of very civic, compassionate, generous, proud Americans. This is Wichita, Kansas.
You were there.
Yes, I was for all 45 of the 46 days I covered.
Judy Thomas covered the protests for the Wichita Eagle and later co-authored a book about the anti-abortion movement. She vividly recalled the event, particularly the first few days when protesters and police were sizing one another up.
The police chief had instructions not to get physical with them.
With the demonstrators.
Exactly, mm-hmm. With the demonstrators. And so they would let them, they called them baby steps, and then it got termed the Wichita Walk. They would take little baby steps, and the police would allow them to do that as long as they were moving. One time it took 26 hours to clear the gates.
So let me understand this. I mean, you have these people physically blocking the entrance, and they're not stationary. They're taking these little bitty mm-hmm. baby steps, but really not going anywhere.
Right.
Right?
And so while they're being hauled off.
Police used two city buses and a rental truck.
They had to bring out buses. They brought out rider trucks or rental vans one day because there were so many protesters to haul off.
Who had to be carried like this former Las Vegas police officer went to the county to be booked.
When he arrived on the scene that first week, Terry, the Operation Rescue leader, seized on a tactical mistake by the Wichita police to inflame public opinion.
Do you believe that excessive force was used?
Definitely.
The police showed up on horseback, and boy, was that a scene. It really was like a melee.
And those horses waded into the crowd in a way that was completely unnecessary and completely unprofessional.
One protester got arrested for, he was trying to stir the horses up. And the scenes looked pretty bad on TV because the horses were in there and they were startled.
As we are told, a woman came here for services at the Wichita Planning Clinic, and she was following horses through when a little riot evolved here out on the streets.
Julie Burkhart was a college student working that summer at one of Wichita's three clinics.
I mean, we had protesters day in, day out. We had blockades. We had people coming into the clinic. We had our windows knocked out. Bricks, rocks were thrown through our windows. Bomb threats.
So, as a staff, did you feel under siege?
Yes, very much so. Yes.
A steady stream of clinic workers and patients were then escorted into the facility.
All we're looking for is to have uninterrupted access to Dr. Tiller's own private property.
There were nights we spent the night in the clinic. There were also days when we would start clinic well before dawn. To beat the anti-choice protesters to the clinic so we could get women in more easily.
Many of the protesters were staying at the same hotel, and Thomas says they would conclude every day with a combination political rally and worship service.
Every night they would have rallies back at the Wichita Plaza Hotel, and they'd all congregate there, and they'd have, you know, Randall Terry or whoever, one of the leaders would get up and speak, and they'd sing, and they'd talk about what happened today and things like that.
We have to keep our minds and our hearts focused on what we're doing.
At the back of the room, they had long tables back there, and, you know, they were selling, you know, pro-life literature and things like that. But they also were signing people up.
Signing people up to run for Republican precinct slots, low-level positions that often go unfilled because the duties are a grind, canvassing neighborhoods and getting people out to vote. But when Election Day rolled around in 1992, most of the anti-abortion activists who had signed up to run for precinct slots, well, they won. And they quickly used their newfound power to take over the Sedgwick County Republican Party.
Dot Meyer was the moderate Republican who was chairman at the time, and she resigned when she realized that there was going to be a coup. And I'll tell you, going to that meeting that night, it was amazing because I'm sitting in there and I'm looking around, and like half the room was people I'd seen out at the clinics getting arrested. There were a ton of them that had been arrested, and now they're precinct committee people. Not only did they take control of that party, but the anti-abortion factions took over, I think it was four of the five biggest counties in Kansas after that. The protests are pretty much what got people out of the pews, into the streets, and then into the political arena.
Meyer's resignation made way for Mark Geetson to become the new county chair. And he was a guy who settled in Wichita by chance in 1978. He was just passing through Kansas on his way to North Dakota to a wedding and noticed that he was running low on gas.
I just thought, well, you know, I could make it up to Salina, which in those days I was pronouncing Salina. And I thought, well, you know, you hate to drive when it's down to like an eighth of a tank and you're wondering, am I going to make it or not? So I said, all right, I'll just pull in here. So spur of the moment idea, I pulled in right across from Boeing and had no intention of working there. But when I was topping off the tank, I thought, well, you know, maybe I ought to look and see what they're paying at Boeing.
The pay was good, so he applied for and got that job. And he got involved in Wichita's anti-abortion movement, really, before it was much of a movement.
You know, I'm from a large family in North Dakota, and my mom and dad were very active in North Dakota Right to Life and the whole Right to Life organization, which was just growing in North Dakota, mostly because of my mom and dad. You know, that's why, you know, I knew what it meant, you know. And so we had Right to Life of Kansas was mostly Overland Park, Kansas City, and really wasn't a whole lot going on here because this was such a Democrat stronghold.
Well, that started to change in the 80s with the election of President Ronald Reagan. But it was those protests in the summer of 91 that finally flipped the politics in Wichita and Sedgwick County. And Geetson was one of the people who made it happen. The day we talked to him, he was protesting outside what used to be Tiller's Clinic.
The point that the Summer of Mercy changed the political landscape of Kansas is 100% true. And you're standing on the ground where it happened. I was out here with a three-ring binder, a notepad, and I want your name. And if you're willing to stand on the street and, you know, stop cars and you know, tell them not to have an abortion and so on, why don't you give me 1 or 2 hours a month and at least vote at the precinct level? They'll say, well, I don't know what a precinct committee man or woman is. And I'm saying, it's perfect. You're the guy I need, or you're the woman I need. And so I would sign up these people. And
okay, now why was that important, though? Why were you doing that?
Because it only makes sense. You know, these people were so riled up. They were ready to, you know, have the French Revolution all over again.
They wanted to do something.
They wanted to, you know, they were ready to come out with the pitchforks. You know, we had the farmers with the tractors once and all that. You know, they were ready to break the law, whatever it took. We're going to not let them kill this baby. And I admire that. I like that. But it's much smarter and wiser to do it within the law. You don't have a revolution when you have a constitution that allows you to elect who you want to do the right thing. The only reason we have abortion is because we've allowed it. They didn't force the Supreme Court did force it on us, but we had a way of correcting that.
You filled those precinct positions.
Yeah.
And pretty quickly after that, those
it
protests.
It was so fascinating how good that worked. I had no idea. It was the most successful thing I ever did.
Because you started electing legislators.
Yeah.
Anti-abortion legislators right off
the bat. It was the most successful thing I ever did. I had no idea it would be that easy. Then I became county chairman. And when I was county chairman, then we became very strong.
Strong enough, says Kansas Senate President Susan Weigel, to immediately start winning seats in the legislature.
Well, the next election, the House went Republican again. And then in 94 was the sweep. The conservatives won the entire House of Representatives. And we threw out the speaker, and Tim Schallenberger became speaker, and I became speaker pro tem.
Tim Schallenberger, a conservative Republican from southeast Kansas, would go on to run for governor in 2002. He lost to Democrat Kathleen Sebelius. Still, his election as speaker was one in a series of turning points that eventually led to conservatives taking control of the state house. Their strength building, anti-abortion lawmakers started passing laws to restrict the procedure. Laws requiring parental consent, a 24-hour waiting period, and tougher licensing standards. They also mandated ultrasounds for women seeking abortions. The goal, says Mary Kay Culp, the leader of Kansans for Life, was to step-by-step reduce the number of abortions performed in Kansas, particularly late-term abortions.
When Roe v. Wade came out, it had with it what is called a strict scrutiny review. Any state law that was passed had to meet this strict scrutiny review, and most of them didn't make it. What has happened over the years is they changed that legal review to an undue burden. as long as the law, state law, is not an undue burden to a woman, it can stand. Well, in Kansas, we have reduced abortions by half by passing laws that met the undue burden standard.
There were other byproducts of the anti-abortion movement in Kansas, according to Julie Burkhart. In 1991, remember, she was a college student working a summer job at one of the Wichita clinics. The experience stuck with her. And 10 years later, she returned to work with Dr. Tiller.
So I'd been living in the Northwest and came back, and I met Dr. Tiller in the spring of 2001. And then I started working directly for him in July of 2002.
Doing what exactly?
I built and ran the political action committee that he founded, Pro Can Do.
While Burkhart was trying to elect lawmakers committed to holding the line on abortion rights, Phil Klein was emerging as a political force in Kansas. A conservative lawmaker from Johnson County, Klein shocked the political establishment by winning the attorney general's race in 2002. And Klein, he was an anti-abortion crusader.
We are destroying a nation. For at its very core, abortion is sin.
Here he is addressing a National Right to Life convention.
And sin always begins with a lie. Because the woman who is frightened and terrified and forced into an abortion by a father who does not care lays on a table. And when the moment occurs, knows that she has participated in ending a life.
The moment he was elected, you know, the floodgates really opened.
As Klein told an interviewer at the Values Voter Summit in 2008, he thought the way to stop abortion was to prosecute providers.
Dr. Tiller has performed abortions, justifying them under Kansas law for things such as I won't be able to compete in rodeo or I don't want to hire a babysitter. They mock the law because they know that those who have the duty to enforce it will ignore it.
Klein went after medical records from Tiller's clinic. Abortion rights advocates called it a witch hunt. The charges were ultimately dropped, but it gave conservative pundits the talking points they needed. Things got more intense, Burkhart says, more hostile. Threats on Dr. Tiller's life were on the rise.
You know, I look at Phil Klein's actions and the person who assassinated Dr. Tiller. Those two people, in my mind, are intertwined. I mean, you can only talk about somebody being a killer for so long and using very violent language before someone is going to take action.
Dr. Tiller himself knew the risks.
There are probably more physicians who get shot working in emergency rooms than there are abortion clinics. There are all sorts of dangers. Postal workers, firemen, police officers. Everything has a risk to it. I would prefer, personally, to have a challenging, stimulating, emotionally and spiritually rewarding career that is short, rather than have a long one that is filled with ho-hum, mundane, mediocrity, feeling as if you don't make any difference to people.
George Tiller was shot and killed in his church on Sunday, May 31st, 2009. Anti-abortion activist Scott Roeder was convicted of his murder and sentenced to 25 years in prison. Kansas anti-abortion advocates condemned Tiller's murder. Still, the political battle remained intense. And the very next year, anti-abortion activists got what they had always wanted. Sam Brownback became the first hard right conservative elected governor of Kansas.
Governor, welcome.
Thank you.
It was 2010, and Brownback was on top of the political heap, with his sights set on transforming Kansas into a conservative utopia, a model for the rest of the nation.
If I haven't made it clear, the days of ever-expanding government are over.
But it didn't last. How the failure of Brownback's red state experiment led to a backlash at the ballot box. That's next time on My Fellow Kansans.
That was Jim McLean of the Kansas News Service with My Fellow Kansans, a podcast that's putting the governor's race in the Sunflower State in context. We're airing episodes of My Fellow Kansans every Tuesday here on KCUR's Central Standard from now until Election Day, so keep listening. The podcast is edited by Amy Jeffries and mixed by Matthew Long Middleton, and we'll be looking forward to what they've got in store for us next Tuesday. Tomorrow, a Kansas writer has a new book about growing up poor in a country that does not really like to acknowledge any kind of class divide. Heartland is on the long list for a National Book Award, and the author, Sarah Smarsh, will join us to talk about it tomorrow at 10. Tune in. And if you missed our conversation about the Leeds neighborhood earlier this hour, it'll be available at kcur.org/Central Standard along with all of our past shows. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Kathleen Pointer, and Suzanne Hogan. Our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross, and you can talk to us on Twitter anytime. We are at KCURCST, and I'm at Gina KCUR. I'm Gina Kaufman, and stick around for Up to Date.